This is Professor Carlson, and this is the lecture scheduled for November 10 in Contracts 1. When we left off, we were discussing the relationship between the statute of frauds and promissory estoppel. Monarco versus LeGreco takes the view that promissory estoppel is a way to overcome the statute of frauds. In other words, if a promise is not enforceable as a contract because it's not in writing, it's still enforceable under promissory estoppel if, in fact, it induced very substantial reliance. The difficulty with this approach is that it tends to undermine the statute of frauds very substantially. In fact, arguably, there's not much left of the statute of frauds if oral promises are enforceable whenever they induce reliance. The counter-argument is that reliance is still a pretty important requirement, and that you could not, for example, overcome the statute of frauds merely by asserting a promise. Lots of oral promises don't induce reliance. It's either substantial or reasonable. Now, when the drafters of the restatement looked at this problem, they had a lot of different approaches to look at. They had California's Monarco versus LeGreco approach. They had the much more conservative approach, which is that you could only use promissory estoppel with respect to a promise to, in fact, put the contract or promise in writing, or a representation that it was already in writing. In any event, the compromise solution you'll find in Restatement Section 139, which is our very first slide for this lecture, and this slide outlines the requirements of Section 139. In essence, it restates all of the Section 90 requirements for promissory estoppel, but in allowing the invocation of promissory estoppel with respect to an oral promise governed by the statute of frauds, note how it varies from Monarco versus LeGreco. For one thing, it retains the general standard that we can rely on promissory estoppel whenever justice requires. And we can highlight the difference between that and Monarco versus LeGreco, because in Monarco, Judge Traynor seemed to require that the non-enforcement would have been unconscionable. The restatement is not so demanding, so in this respect, the restatement is perhaps even more liberal than Monarco versus LeGreco. It only requires that justice requires enforcement, not that non-enforcement would be absolutely unconscionable. On the other hand, it is more conservative than Monarco versus LeGreco because it adds some additional factors relating to the justice of the situation. For example, it has to be a situation in which the other remedies, contract and restitution, for example, are unavailable to the injured party for some reason. It has to be a situation in which we couldn't otherwise avoid the statute of frauds by, for example, the doctrine of part performance. Finally, it has to be a situation in which the reliance is not only substantial and reasonable, but the reliance also in some fashion corroborates the fact that a promise must have been made. And remember that when we say that it corroborates the promise, what we mean is that the reliance makes it unlikely that we would have had this kind of conduct but for the fact that there was a promise. And this will be especially persuasive if the promisor seems to have permitted or condoned or allowed that reliance to go forward knowingly, knowing, for example, that this must mean the promisee thinks I actually made some kind of a promise to them. Important caveat here, not all states have adopted Section 139. Some still follow the more conservative approach that you can't avoid the statute of frauds by promissory estoppel unless there was a promise to put the contract in writing or a promise that the writing was already that the promise was already in writing. Texas, by the way, is undecided. I'll simply say that Texas case law as of today is mixed. You have at least some authority that seems to have adopted Section 139, although it's not absolutely clear that that's where Texas is going. You can advance to the next slide. Here we have promissory estoppel and UCC Section 2-201. What does the code say about all of this? Does it adopt the promissory estoppel view? Well, again, we have no clear answer. Even after half a century, the code is unclear. Different states have taken different approaches to the problem, which makes the UCC perhaps not uniform in this respect. It all depends on what state law governs. One argument is that 2-201, the code's version of the statute of frauds, it lists exceptions to the usual requirement of a writing, and it doesn't list estoppel. And one could argue that that is omission by implication. If the drafters of the code had intended that promissory estoppel should apply, it would have been another subpart of 2-201. On the other hand, there's another interesting provision of the code. It's in Article 1, 1-103, and it arguably permits estoppel as part of the so-called supplementary common law. Remember that the drafters of the code understood they couldn't write all of the law in one limited code, so they wrote the rules that they wanted to be sure of, and they provided a rule that the common law still exists to the extent that we have not in some fashion negated it. And in this case, one could make the argument that since the drafters of the code did not expressly exclude promissory estoppel, it's still there in the background, at least in those states that permit promissory estoppel. In any event, the courts remain divided about what the proper answer is, so we don't really have a uniform rule under the Uniform Commercial Code. What's the result, by the way, in international law under the Convention on the International Sale of Goods? Well, the answer is very simple. Remember, there is no statute of frauds in the CISG. So under the CISG, of course, any oral promise is enforceable with or without reliance. Let's advance to the next slide. This begins a new section, a new chapter, policing the bargain for unsavory bargaining tactics and grossly unfair bargaining results. Let's advance to the next slide. This is policing the bargain, a possible checklist. What do we mean by judicial policing of the bargain? Didn't we say that the courts didn't really care what the outcome of bargaining would be? Well, as is usual, there are some limits. Here is a checklist. Number one, we're going to be talking about capacity of the parties. It turns out that not everyone is allowed to play. Number two, we'll be talking about behavioral rules. Some rules, in fact, regulate how players behave on the field. For example, as we've already discussed in an earlier part of this course, using duress or coercion is one of those things that you're not allowed to do. Number three, substantive fairness. We're going to violate a rule that we started out with, which is that courts are unconcerned with the equality of the bargain. But remember that a grossly unequal bargain is always a red flag that maybe there was some violation of the behavioral rules or the capacity rules. What's more, we're going to see that in an extreme case, a court might actually hold that the outcome is so bad, you shouldn't be allowed to use taxpayer resources and judicial machinery to carry out what was really an unscrupulous bargain. And finally, we'll see that public policy rules sometimes come into play. Aside from the fact that the bargain may or may not be unequal, there may be reasons why the court just doesn't want to enforce it. It doesn't want to involve itself in the enforcement of a transaction that's just plain bad. For example, a drug deal. It doesn't matter whether the buyer and seller negotiated equally and got a fair result. The simple answer is the courts aren't going to promote criminal activity. Let's advance now to the next slide. Incapacity. Incapacity is the idea that some people just can't make contracts. They're not permitted to play. Now, the rules of capacity have changed rather substantially through the ages. We're going to be talking mainly about age and mental capacity, but let's just note in passing that over time there have been other groups of people who are not permitted to play. For example, up until about 1866 in the state of Texas, African Americans were not permitted to make contracts. Their contracts were not binding, and therefore African Americans were unable to engage in any kind of substantial business. Up until some much later time in many states, women who married lost their capacity to make contracts. The idea was that they were completely subservient on their husbands, who were the only family members who were in a position to make any kind of business contracts. These examples remind us that rules on capacity aren't just designed to protect people, they are also designed to oppress people. And of course, if you've been the parent of teenagers, you will have heard many, many times that rules regarding capacity are intended to oppress, even when they're designed to protect young people. Now, we're going to start out with the limited modern rules of capacity. We're talking mainly age capacity. Today, for example, young people under the age of 18 lack capacity to make binding contracts. We'll also be talking about mental incapacity, either temporary or persistent. Next slide. This takes us to Kiefer versus Fred Howe Motors. The facts in this case involve the purchase of an automobile by a minor under the age of 21. This case, by the way, arose at a time when the age of capacity in most states was, in fact, 21. That was before the Vietnam War. It was after the Vietnam War that every state that I'm familiar with reformed their law so that the age of capacity was lowered to 18. Next slide. Looking at Kiefer, you might have argued that aside from his age, in many respects, he actually looked like and behaved like an adult. After all, he was married, he was a father, he had a job, he was financially independent, and as far as we can tell, was living independently of his mother, except for the fact that he had needed to borrow her car before the purchase of this particular car. So he's acting like an adult in many ways. Does it matter that in many respects he was acting and perhaps, in fact, very mature for his years? And by the way, you've probably known some people who simply matured faster than others. Maybe Kiefer was one of those sorts of persons. The question, does it matter? And the answer is no, it doesn't matter. When it comes to age-based capacity, we're dealing with a bright, clear line. Something happens at a particular moment on a particular day. Actually, the restatement's pretty particular about this. It gets right down to the particular day when you suddenly gain your capacity. As I recall, it's actually the day before your birthday. In any event, it's a bright, clear line. On one side of that line, before your birthday, you are incapable of making a binding contract. Cross over that line, blow out the candles, have your birthday celebration, and miraculously, you become a mature person who is bound by your legal decisions. Of course, you might not be any more mature one day than the next, but it just doesn't matter. What is the effect when a minor negotiates a contract? The answer is that the contract exists in a way, but it is a voidable contract. Now, there's an important difference between voidable on the one hand and void on the other. A voidable contract is a contract that actually exists, but one of the parties, sometimes both, but at least one of the parties, has the right to disaffirm or reject the contract. They are not bound. They can get out. And in this case, that would be the child. The child is not bound, and therefore the child could choose not to perform the contract, or the child has an option. The child can carry out the contract and demand performance by the adult. Now, the child retains this right to disaffirm the contract up until a reasonable time after his majority. He's got until he turns 18, because remember, we presumed he's not mature enough to make this decision until he reaches his 18th birthday. And even then, there are reasons why we might allow a few days to make a careful decision. We also might want to remember that frequently it doesn't occur to you immediately on your birthday that you have contracts out there that you need to make decisions about. So we're going to allow you some time after you've blown out the candles and awakened from a hard day of celebration. You still have a reasonable amount of time to decide what are you going to do about those voidable contracts that you made. My last bullet on this slide raises the question, is the adult really bound by a contract if the child does not disaffirm? It's a question I've wondered about, and I've looked for reported court decisions that might answer this question. There's really very little out there. We could say a lot about why there are so few cases involving contracts by minors. Let me simply say that I think the answer is this, that if a contract really is voidable by the child, arguably the child isn't really bound by a promise, and that makes the contract one without consideration from the adult's point of view. After all, if the child is not bound, the child has not made a legally binding promise, the child's promise is in a sense illusory, what have I, the adult, received in exchange for my promise? And the answer is nothing. So I think although the courts frequently say that the contract is voidable only at the option of the child, the truth is it's not really binding on either party. But the parties, of course, could willingly or perhaps unknowingly perform the contract anyway, which is exactly what happens in a lot of cases. Next slide. Potential remedies for the adult. The court discusses at some length some of the possible remedies that an adult might have against the child who has made a contract at perhaps some expense and cost to the adult. Here are some of the potential solutions. Number one, undue delay in disaffirming the contract after majority. That would constitute what we would call ratification. And you can do it knowingly or unknowingly. You do it simply by failing to disaffirm the contract. By the way, what is disaffirmation? It could happen in a number of different ways. It could happen if you repudiate your promise as a child, or in this case, it happened by Kiefer bringing the car back in and asking for his money back. Now, we asked the question before. How much time do you have after you turn 18 in order to disaffirm your contract? We said a reasonable amount of time. We don't know in the Kiefer case how long Kiefer waited, but we're led to believe that it was not very long, and so this is not going to work for the adult dealer. On the other hand, we can picture a case in which Kiefer, on his birthday, thinks about the fact that his car doesn't work very well. And then he thinks, well, you know, I'm kind of a daredevil. I think I'm going to take this lunky old car and drive it across the country. I just got interrupted by a phone call, and I'm trying to remember where I left off. I believe I was talking about Kiefer driving this damaged automobile. He thinks he's going to drive it across the country. He knows he can turn it in, but maybe he's thinking to himself, you know, as long as I can get my money back anyway, why not use this car up just as much as I can, and only after I put another 10,000 miles on it will I return it. Well, if you quickly used up the goods and then tried to turn them back in, It's the extent to which you consciously used the goods as much as the time delay that might cause this to be a ratification. But we have no reason to believe that that happened in this case. Second bullet, we have emancipation. I cover emancipation a little bit in my family law class. It's hard to generalize here because I'll tell you the rules of emancipation vary tremendously from one state to the next. Texas is got one approach. In Texas, Kiefer would have been emancipated. He would have been an adult even if he'd been only 17 years old. And I say that because he happens to have been married. Marriage emancipates and converts your minor status into adulthood. But that evidently wasn't the approach in this other state where the Kiefer versus Fred Howe Motors case arises. Number three, purchase of necessaries. As a kind of an emergency doctrine, courts have sometimes held that children could engage in transactions like buying food or accommodations in an emergency. And that's what the courts have typically meant by necessaries. Again, it's something we deal with a little bit in the family law class. We'll simply say that there could arguably be an instance in which you could claim that a car was a necessary. But I tend to think that's pretty far-fetched given what the law typically has said in the past about what qualifies as a necessary. It has to be something much closer to an emergency. And you'll see that this court isn't really ready to treat an automobile as a necessary. Next bullet, restitution of goods. At the very least, you'll note that the dealer is entitled to get the car back. And of course, that's exactly what Kiefer did. He returned the car. The dealer might not think of this as much of a remedy. After all, he's got the car back, but it's perhaps worth even less than it was when Kiefer bought it. And of course, the dealer gets none of his profit. He's borne all of the other expenses of the transaction. And by the way, what if Kiefer had an accident on his way back to the dealer? He smashed the car into a tree. The answer is that he doesn't have to make restitution then because he has got nothing to give. Same is true if the child gets services, for example, a haircut, that he can't simply return. Same is true for any kind of contract that doesn't involve goods and that doesn't involve something that can be returned. Next bullet, estoppel. If there was an intentional misrepresentation of his age, then we, in some jurisdictions, in at least a few states, would apply something resembling promissory estoppel. The child is bound by his representation. But note the limitations here. First of all, the representation has to be intentional. Secondly, the parties, the dealer has to have acted reasonably. And courts will tend to be protective of children in situations like this. After all, if you're a merchant, you should know that it's dangerous to make transactions with people who pretend to be adults if they're very obviously children. The remedy in case of an estoppel is to treat the transaction as a binding contract. Kiefer might not be allowed to return the vehicle subject to breach of warranty, and he might be required to tender the payment. Finally, there's tort for an intentional misrepresentation, also a potential tort for damage to property if the automobile has been damaged by Kiefer's negligence. But again, important limitations here. It's not fraud unless Kiefer intended to misrepresent his age. And you'll note what happened in this case. The parties used a form contract with some print on it that said, I represent that I am an adult. And as far as we can tell, there was no positive affirmation or statement by Kiefer that he was under 21. He simply signed the document, perhaps not reading it very carefully. And signing a document without having carefully read it doesn't make your statements on that form your representation for purposes of fraud, because it's too easy for you simply to say, I didn't do it on purpose. It was not my intent to mislead the other party. A careful dealer will not rely on that kind of technique to get a representation from the buyer. He will have a separate piece of paper, which very clearly has something to do about age, particularly if he's dealing with somebody who looks like they might not yet be an adult. And finally, again, courts are protective of children, and we know children do silly things sometimes, and we expect merchants to be careful about these things. I'll tell you, as an experienced parent, and some of you yourselves might be experienced parents, or some of you are simply experienced teenagers, so you'll know this too, and that is, there are a lot of merchants out there who consciously profit and do business by either marketing to children or, in fact, preying on children. They know what they are doing. They know what kind of customers they've got, and they'd rather not know whether they are really dealing with adults or not. Next slide. Take a moment to look at this, then put this on pause while you're thinking about it, and then start it up again. I'm going to assume now that you've had a chance to read and think about Mindy Miner's problem. You might wonder, what kind of important contracts do children make, aside from buying goods down at the Galleria Mall? And the answer is, one very important kind of contract that we see children making a lot are employment contracts. Now you might ask, well, what kinds of promises do children make as employees? And there are a couple of possibilities. The most important kind of promise a child might make today is the arbitration clause in the employment contract. And we're seeing an awful lot of sexual harassment claims, particularly, I'll say, in the restaurant industry, because you get a lot of young girls working in restaurants, and the managers or male employees then harass them. Now, is it a defense to Title VII federal anti-discrimination law that you were dealing with a child? Well, to tell the truth, I think that makes it a lot worse. So when the child employee brings a lawsuit against the employer, the problem is that the child's promise that they will not bring a lawsuit, that they will only submit the case to arbitration, it's certainly not binding. Now, what about the potential delay here? Mindy turned 18 before she actually filed the claim. And this is a pretty good example of why we allow a so-called reasonable delay in this affirmation. And it also is a good example of why it is that what constitutes reasonable delay is not strictly a matter of time, it's also a matter of circumstances. The odds are that when Mindy Miner signed that handbook, she didn't read it very carefully. She never really thought much about the consequences of an arbitration clause. And we wouldn't really expect much of her in that regard, because that's, after all, why we protect children from binding contracts. So when would we expect her to think about whether or not she should affirm, disaffirm, or ratify her contract? And the answer is, she's not really required to make this decision until she has reason to remember that she even made the promise. And it's at the point when she files her claim that she has to make that decision. In the particular case that I'm thinking about here in Texas, the court held that the filing of the lawsuit was her disaffirmation of her promise, and that even though this happened many months after she turned 18, this was not an unreasonable amount of delay under the circumstances. The employer, for example, was not at all prejudiced by this particular amount of delay. Next slide. Ordinary versus Teachers Retirement Board moves us into another kind of capacity problem, not age-based capacity, but mental capacity. Trouble with mental or emotional capacity is that there are no bright, clear lines, and that's clearly the case in Ortolari, where we have a woman who, now deceased, her estate and her husband are seeking to avoid and disaffirm a decision that she made. Next slide. What were the signs of incapacity? Well, as I mentioned, mental incapacity has no clear line. It is relative and progressive. As we get older, for example, we may gradually lose our mental capacity. Those of you who have very elderly parents will already be observing this. You'll note that someone who was once a rocket scientist now acts more and more like a young child in some respect, and they need help even with the remote on the TV. They were making rockets one day and shooting them to the moon, and the next day they're having trouble programming or inserting a disk in their own computer. Now, that's what I mean by this gradual creeping lack of capacity. It doesn't happen all at once, and there's no bright, clear line from one side to the other. It is relative and it is progressive. Some particular signs that Ortolari was incapacitated. Well, the school had granted her a leave of absence for emotional illness. That ought to have been a red flag right there. She consulted with the school district's own in-house doctor. That should have been a red flag for the school. After her death, we have a medical diagnosis, and let me add, it's always useful and important in a mental incapacity case to be able to put your finger on a label and to have an expert who can testify about what it is. In this case, at the time it was called involutional psychosis. Today we would more likely call it severe depression. Finally, it is noteworthy that her husband had retired to take care of her. That's further objective evidence. Even after she's died, there's objective evidence that can prove that her mental state must have been quite limited. Next slide. Now, there are two approaches to the problem of mental incapacity. Again, there's the old way of doing things, and there's also a more modern approach. The restatement, rather than simply taking one view or the other, breaks it into two and says we adopt both approaches. You can take either of two roads here. One is the old-fashioned approach. We'll call it the cognitive rule, and it is described in section 15.1a. It's a very limited rule, and it requires something like classic insanity, and it's a bright, clear line in this sense. You were either capable or completely incapable. There is no in-between state as far as this particular rule is concerned. The test is whether the promisor could understand the nature of the transaction. For example, did Mrs. Ortolari understand that she was making a retirement election, or did she think that she was the Empress Catherine of Russia dividing up Poland as a treaty with Germany? If it was the latter case, she didn't understand the nature of the transaction, she was delusional, and she was completely incapable of making a binding contract. So, what do we look for as evidence of that kind of incapacity? Delusions. You know, I'm Napoleon, I'm signing a treaty with Britain, I'm not just selling my house. Am I able to make a rational decision? You know, I'm buying tons and tons of oats because I have to feed my cavalry of horses that I'm using to fight the battle against the British. If the state of mind is that severe, then clearly we have a problem of cognitive incapacity. But this requires the same kind of incapacity that would lead to a party's complete disability from doing anything, perhaps their commitment in a mental institution, for example, or the appointment of a guardian or a conservator. Next slide. The restatement also adopts a more modern approach, which accounts for the more gradual loss of mental capacity and the partial loss of mental capacity. In other words, not total mental incapacity, but diminished capacity, something less than what you had before, for example. And you'll find the restatement's version of this rule in section 15.1, subpart B. We're talking here about diminished capacity that is not necessarily completely disabling. The standard is that the promisor was unable to act in a reasonable manner. They were acting unreasonably. For example, Mrs. Ordinary suddenly made a remarkable decision. She was going to, in essence, to cheat her husband out of a retirement policy. And not only was this person acting unreasonably, maybe they were a bit paranoid, maybe they were no longer able to deal rationally and reasonably with their friends and their family, they were acting strangely. And there's a second part to this test: the other contracting party had a reason to know. Maybe they had a reason to know from their observation of the behavior of the other party. And I'll tell you, frequently when you're dealing with people who are at this level of incapacity, it's not always immediately true. I'm thinking about a particular experience when a person walks into my office, and for the first 15 minutes they seem perfectly normal, and suddenly at about the 16th minute things start to gradually head downhill, and you realize that this person is not completely there. Possibly in the midst of the transaction, things happened that put you on notice that this person really didn't have complete capacity. Now, what's the result if you take advantage of someone knowing that their capacity has been diminished? They're not ready for commitment, but, for example, they've had clearly too much to drink, or they are severely depressed or paranoid, and you're perhaps manipulating that. You're taking advantage of it. At the very least, you're making a deal with someone who you should know perhaps wouldn't be making this deal but for their lack of full capacity. The result is judicial discretion. The court can ask itself, well, was the resulting contract fair? Was this a case of exploitative behavior by the promisee? Has the contract already been partly performed so that we should require at least some payment for services already rendered? And the court can do whatever it deems to be just under the circumstances. Next slide. Is this a case of diminished capacity? Well, again, remember that what we're dealing with here is severe depression. We need to be careful about things like severe depression, because the truth is that perhaps, I would be at grave risk of being off a little bit if I tried to hazard a guess about the proportion of the population that will at some point experience severe depression, but it's pretty large. And we want to ask the question, are we actually going to hold the people who have depression suddenly lack capacity to make contracts? And that would be an extraordinary and perhaps very dangerous conclusion, and in fact it could even make things worse for people who either temporarily or permanently suffer this kind of condition. So let's address some of the other important questions. Was the contract unreasonable? And the fact is that electing for a single life payout is not necessarily an unreasonable thing to do. People might gamble on life. She might have thought that her life would go on longer than her husband's life. So on its face, it's not a plainly unreasonable contract. Was her illness the cause of an unfair contract? Even if we thought that the result in this case was a bit unfair, we'd also have to answer the question, was it unfair because of her depression? And that's not altogether clear. Did she make this option because she simply no longer cared about her husband, who had, after all, retired to take care of her? Or was it because she guessed that his health was failing and that she was going to live longer. Who knows? None of this is very clear. Did the school district have reason to know of her illness? Well, this is the problem of bureaucracy, right? We had some officials in the school district who obviously must have known that she was depressed. Certainly the district doctor. On the other hand, the poor official in human resources who sits down with her to work out the details of her retirement, did they happen to know about what was going on? And the answer is not necessarily. Finally, should the court exercise discretion? Well, at this point you might be wondering, does the court really need to exercise discretion? Is this really a case for avoiding the contract? And in answering this question, consider the fact that courts, which are made up of human judges, not computers or machines, it's looking at this case, and Mrs. Ortolari is not the only one who's really before the court. Officially, she's, in a sense, the party to the contract. But the court's also thinking about Mr. Ortolari. And I guess I'd like to suggest that this case is kind of a stretch, perhaps, on the case of diminished capacity in terms of setting aside her legal decision. But the court is probably quite protective of Mr. Ortolari as well. And that's what makes this case kind of difficult. Who's the court really protecting here, Mrs. Ortolari or Mr. Ortolari? Now, it was cases like this that caused a little bit of a sensation. It's very troubling what happened to Mr. Ortolari. He really would have been screwed in this case, but for the court's invocation of the doctrine of diminished capacity. There are perhaps better solutions to this problem, and I'll tell you that federal pension law now offers a potential solution. It requires, for example, that a spouse cannot make the kind of election that Mrs. Ortolari made without the other spouse's consent. Let me add, by the way, it's not a perfect solution because ERISA, the federal law that says that, would not have applied to a public school district's pension plan. Next slide. Rules for behavior. We talked about the fact that courts sometimes police bargaining by looking at the way people behave in the bargaining process, and that's what we'll be talking about next. Let's start with a revisitation of a problem we studied before. Coercion and duress are clearly one type of bargaining technique that the courts are going to police against. Next slide. Duress and bargaining. Let's review what we know because we learned it before. Duress is a defense leading to rescission of the contract. It means the contract is not really binding. But the common law limited duress to cases involving a threat to take unlawful action. By the way, it's a good occasion for me to talk a little bit about the practice exam. Some of you went off on a bit of a tangent to talk about the fact that the developers who wanted Selson's land twisted his arm to get him to agree to deal with them, because if he didn't, they were going to take certain actions under another contract. Many of you thought that that was duress because it put Selson in a difficult position. Not even close. Not even close. There was no duress in that case. A duress in the popular sense, but not in the legal sense, because there's nothing improper, there's nothing unlawful in telling somebody, look, you owe me money. Pay up, or maybe we can cut some other deal. And to tell somebody that you aren't going to sue to collect money that they owe, if they give you certain other benefits, there's just nothing improper in that, as long as the deal that you're proposing isn't improper in and of itself. So that's the important limitation of common law duress, and since so many people got off on that wrong tangent, I want to emphasize this. Don't even think about talking about duress as a possible defense unless you either have clearly unlawful behavior, a threat of unlawful behavior, or some of the other special rules that we're about to talk about. If the threatening party has the right to take the action, that he threatens to take, then it's just not duress as a defense to a contract. Now, we've discussed in the earlier part of this semester problems involving lawful threats that still trouble us a lot, particularly a threat to file a frivolous lawsuit or a threat to breach a contract. Remember that filing a lawsuit's not criminal, though. And we want to encourage people to feel free to file lawsuits, even if we disagree with their claims. We also don't want to hold that breaching a contract is unlawful. Remember the efficient breach theory. We don't punish people for breaching their contracts. How do we deal with that kind of duress? Frequently, we're still troubled that the threat to file a frivolous lawsuit or the threat not to perform can still undermine our goals of voluntary exchange. And so remember at this point that the courts have invented some rather narrow rules of consideration to deal with that. They don't deal with it head on by dealing with it as a kind of duress. What they say is that the threat or the promise to settle a frivolous lawsuit is simply worth less than a peppercorn, and that the bargaining to perform something that you are already required to do is also less than a peppercorn under the pre-existing duty rule. So the courts dealt with those situations not as duress, but as a lack of consideration. Next slide, duress and bargaining, economic duress theory. As those immediately prior examples suggest, there are some lawful threats that are still dishonest or in bad faith, such as the opportunistic demand in the midst of contract performance. And if you remember our discussion, particularly in the pre-existing duty rule or in the settlement of claims, another way of describing what's going on, and some courts have more clearly explained it this way, it involves a slight revision of the test of duress. Are the usual remedies available to the poor promisor, for example, defending a frivolous lawsuit or suing for a breach of contract, are those remedies really adequate? And the answer is sometimes they're not adequate at all. And the explanation of this, you'll see, was in the Austin versus Loral case on the pre-existing duty rule. But let's move on now, because we have other forms of improper bargaining conduct to deal with. Misrepresentation and concealment are our next topics. So let's advance now to the next slide, unequal access to information. One knows more than the other. The picture there is of Galileo at his telescope. You may wonder, what does Galileo have to do with misrepresentation and concealment? Well, here's a story that may or may not be true. It may just be a bit of legend, but it may actually have a kernel of truth in it. Galileo didn't just look at the stars. He also used his telescope as a terrestrial telescope. In other words, he could look out across the land. More importantly, he could look out across the ocean. Using his telescope, he discovered that he could learn things faster than other people could learn them. For example, he could look out on the horizon and he could see if ships were arriving or whether they were not arriving. And he could learn this long before anyone else. So he'd go to the very top of the tallest tower in the land so that he could see over the horizon. And then he would use his telescope to see farther than the human eye, perhaps 50, 100 miles out. He would see, for example, not just one, not just two, but lots and lots of ships headed to the port of Genoa. And he knew what this meant. It meant that the grain deliveries were on the way. Now, people down below, they didn't know this. They were very worried. They thought maybe the grain shortage would continue. Therefore, grain prices should be very, very high. And prices were, in fact, high down beneath the tower, below Galileo. He learns that prices are going to be really low tomorrow because the ships are arriving. Naturally, he will go down to ground level And he will make lots and lots and lots of contracts to sell grain. Now, as you know, Galileo's no farmer. In fact, he doesn't own any grain. So why would he be making all of these contracts to sell grain that he doesn't really have? And the answer is, he knows that when those ships arrive tomorrow, they will be selling lots and lots of grain. And they're going to be selling it at a really, really low price, because now people realize there's plenty of grain to go around. So he's going to buy up as much grain as he can, and then he's going to fulfill all those contracts that he made. But the buyer on the other end of those transactions will be paying yesterday's exorbitant price for grain. So very quickly, Galileo and his friends will make a huge profit. Now, that's a problem of unequal access to information. One knows more than the other. Why does this happen? Number one, you have invested in investigation and perhaps machinery and instruments that allow you to do this. Galileo spent a lot of time perfecting the telescope, and he figured out ways of putting it to use. That was his investment in research. We could also talk about education and experience. You're going to law school and you're learning all sorts of things that people who haven't been to law school don't know about. We could talk about one's personal experience with the thing being sold. That's a case where the seller almost always knows a lot more about the thing than the buyer does, because the seller has had possession of the thing, he's used it, he has real experience with it. Personal experience with the thing being bought is much less likely, but in just a moment we're going to have an example of where the buyer actually knows more about the seller. Expensive investigation of a particular subject matter. You hired inspectors at some great cost to yourself to look more carefully at the thing that a non-professional could do. And finally, chance or surreptitious acquisition of information. You wander onto somebody else's property. By chance or accident, you discover an unknown spring or a vein of gold, and suddenly you know more than even the seller does. Next slide. This begins Laidlaw versus Oregon, a famous U.S. Supreme Court case involving very unevenly distributed news. Hopefully you can remember from your history classes that one of the greatest battles in American history, the Battle of New Orleans, fought by General Jackson, was in fact a mistake. That battle was fought 2 weeks after the war had ended, and that was because of the slow and uneven distribution of news. Some people in the world knew that the war was over. Sadly, for the mainly British soldiers who died in that battle, the news hadn't yet reached the port of New Orleans. Next slide. Is there a duty to disclose? What happened in this case? Well, the buyer knew something that the seller did not know. Cotton is about to go sky high. The reason that cotton's going to go sky high is that up until now, there's been an embargo that has prevented cotton sellers from getting their cotton out of New Orleans. It's just amassed there in New Orleans. It's piling up on the docks, and we can't sell it. There's nothing that we can do with it because we can't get it out of New Orleans. The British have us surrounded, and this makes cotton practically worthless. So what's the right price for cotton? The buyer and the seller had been trying to figure that out, and suddenly the buyer knows something the seller does not. It may be practically worthless today, but it's going to be very valuable tomorrow when the ships start coming back into port to pick it up and to buy it and take it off to Europe. Well, the buyer knows something the seller does not. The usual rule is that the buyer has no duty to disclose a fact of which the other party is aware. That's the simple message of this case. A complete non-duty to disclose. Concealment is of no legal significance. The court has a simple way of explaining this. It says, you know, think about all the facts that could be involved in a transaction. There are likely to be many, many facts known by one but not the other party. So exactly where would the court start to draw the line between what must be disclosed and what need not be disclosed? Next slide. The court's caveat emptor rule. As you may know, caveat emptor is Latin for buyer beware. Again, how much disclosure would the law require? It would be hard to have a bright, clear line here. And that would put all transactions at risk because possibly any omission would lead to a rescission of the contract. And that would make you worry about your contracts a lot more. A failure to disclose something would just be too easy for the other party to allege as a basis for rescinding the contract. We can also think of some additional reasons for caveat emptor. Maybe we ought to reward either party's investment in education, research, and investigation because it costs them something to do that. And we should allow people to reap the profit of that kind of effort. Also, we should remember that buyers are not necessarily helpless in this situation. After all, they can investigate on their own. They can send couriers out to gather information about the latest news about the treaty negotiations in Ghent. We can ask questions. Have you heard? Do you have any information about the treaty in Ghent? Has there been any progress? Is the war over or is the war still going on? And finally, we can demand warranties or impose other conditions in the negotiation of the contract. It is a condition of this contract that the war will, in fact, continue for at least a few more weeks while we are trading our cotton here. Next slide, exceptions to a no-duty rule. The court in passing, not only in passing, in actuality, it says there's no duty to disclose, but then it remands the case for retrial because it says even though there's no duty to disclose, there's at least been an allegation that the buyer practiced some imposition on the seller. What the heck does that mean? What would be an imposition? Well, you could only answer that question by looking very carefully at the record in the case. And I'll confess that I haven't scoured the record to know all of the possible things that the court might be referring to. But here's some possibilities. Here is a checklist of things that might have been going on. Number one, was there a confidential or fiduciary relationship between the parties such that one party was dependent on the other? Now, the classic confidential relationships would be parent and child, attorney and client, trustee and beneficiary, and the list could go on because presently the courts are a bit more expansive than they used to be about what might be a confidential relationship. Husband and wife are now in a confidential relationship, although it may be difficult to know who is dependent on whom in that situation. Suffice it to say, in this case, two independent business people operating at arm's length are not in a confidential or fiduciary relationship. So that's not going to fly. But if it did, then the superior party would owe a duty of disclosure. By the way, in some of the modern forms of a confidential or fiduciary relationship, like spouses or partners in a firm, neither party really has to be the superior one. They both owe duties of disclosure to the other. Secondly, unintentional misrepresentation. If it were an intentional misrepresentation, it would be a tort, in other words, fraud, with possible damages to be awarded in tort. But that would require that the buyer must have lied to the seller. He must have said, oh, I just came back from the British barracks on the other side of town. They tell me that the war isn't finished and they plan to march all the way to St. Louis. If the buyer had said that, that would have been fraud. It would have been a positive misstatement and it would have been a ground not only to rescind the contract but also to claim a tort and damages. We don't know if that happened in this case. That will be one of the questions to be investigated on remand. Second possibility, negligent misrepresentation. In other words, maybe it would turn out that the buyer didn't really know whether the war was ongoing or not, or maybe he had received false information and he told the seller, I've heard that the war has gone forward, the negotiations in Ghent have failed, and the U.S. and Britain will be at war for another year. Well, we don't, again, know if there was anything in the way of a negligent misrepresentation by the buyer. Now, let me point out that after Laidlaw, we have two further developments that may or may not have been exemplified by what actually happened in this case. First, we'll talk about the what might be the single most important exception to the usual no duty to disclose rule. And it is a rule, a variation of the rule that some states, including Texas, appear to follow now. The rule is this, that there is, in fact, a duty to disclose any defect which is both material, for example, it would have affected the buyer's decision to buy, and latent. It was a defect that no usual or normal amount of caution would have disclosed. It was, for example, something that an inspection could not have revealed. I'll give you the classic example of this, and that would be, let's say, radon gas, I think is a good example. I started practicing law at a time when people in the real estate industry first discovered the problem of radon gas. It's something that percolates up through the ground. It's radioactive, and it fills up a house, at least in those locations where they have radon gas underneath the ground. Now, I can tell you, luckily, we don't have this problem in Texas. We did have it in Georgia for a while. And suppose you had bought a Geiger counter and had measured radioactivity in your home. You knew this, and you failed to disclose it to the buyer. It's a pretty material fact. You know, if the buyer knew that he was going to become radioactive if he bought this house, he wouldn't have bought it, right? Secondly, it was what we would call a latent defect. None of the usual devices for protecting yourself work here because for a long time it would not have occurred to you to ask about radon. Most people didn't even know that radon existed. And secondly, it wouldn't have occurred to you to ask for the sorts of warranties or disclosures that might have protected you from a thing like radon. And that would have been a perfect occasion for that kind of rule. By the way, that rule didn't yet exist anywhere, as far as I know, at the time of Laidlaw versus Oregon. Finally, courts have become much more sensitive to that last bullet, tricks to distract the other party from learning the truth. I won't say that courts have only recently started to become sensitive to this, but they have become more sensitive to the fact that there are a bunch of things that sellers sometimes do to keep us from asking the right questions. And the classic trick is to make us feel hurried. If you don't buy this car within the next 30 minutes, it will be gone forever. This deal is only possible if you accept right here on the spot, because if you think about it overnight, it will occur to you that this is not a very good deal at all, or you'll start asking important questions, and we don't want you to do that. Next slide. Laidlaw versus Oregon. Let's also consider the unilateral mistake angle. We've talked about unilateral mistake back in the chapter on offer and acceptance. It's another way of dealing with inequality of information. Remember what the requirements of that doctrine would be, however. Was the mistake about an existing fact, there either is or is not a war, or was it a prediction about future market price? The way that you look at this case and you present it as a lawyer is potentially decisive. And the reason for that is that courts rarely grant relief for an error in a prediction about price, even when it's based on information that one party has and the other one does not have it. Because if we open up the door for treating all mistakes about predictions in price to be treated as mistakes, then hardly any contract is binding anymore. Did the buyer also have reason to know of the seller's error? Well, certainly he did in this case, if we had to ask that question. But we'd also have to ask the question, did the seller act carelessly? Did he have any duty to investigate? And we might say that to the extent he knew that peace might be on the horizon, he probably should have been very suspicious about somebody arriving at the crack of dawn after having ridden his horse all the way across New Orleans as if he was eager to get this deal done just as soon as possible. Next slide. Next slide is going to deal with Canavis versus Aninho, but I think I'm going to take a break at this point, divide this up into two, and this will conclude part one, and I will separately be recording part two.